Good morning to all of you. I would like to welcome you here on behalf of the Migration Policy Institute, and thank you for spending the last Monday of the first month of 2011 with us. My name is Muzaffar Chishti. I direct the Migration Policy Institute's office at NYU School of Law. Today's briefing is to mark the release of MPI's new report, Delegation and Divergence, a study of 287G state and local immigration enforcement. This report is part of MPI's research on U.S. immigration and integration policy. Other reports and further information can be found on our website, so that if you are able to write, please do. It's www.migrationpolicy.org. We are pleased to have a very distinguished panel here to present the report and give us our comments on the report. My co-author and my dear colleague, Randy Capps, will discuss the findings and the recommendations of our report. We will then hear from Captain Leroy Kierkegaard of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department and from Jerry Gonzalez of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. Beth Gibson from ICE was supposed to join us this morning. We unfortunately heard at the last minute that she could not be with us this morning, and we frankly don't know why. But we are glad that the other members are with us. Their biographies and longer versions are at your chairs, so feel free to read them, but I'll introduce them separately. I also want to let you know that after their presentations, we'll have a brief question and answer series. We're also glad that C-SPAN is here so that this is being webcast across airwaves. Before I ask our speakers to speak, let me just tell you very quickly how and why we got here. I think most of you know that the devolution of immigration enforcement policy from the federal to the state governments and localities is one of the most important developments in our immigration policy in the last two decades or so. A milestone in this happened in 1996, when the changes in our immigration policy gave birth to a new section to our Immigration Nationality Act called Section 287G. Section 287G, again, probably most of you know, authorizes the federal government to enter into agreements with states and localities to carry out certain aspects of immigration enforcement. Though it was put on books in 1996, not a single contract was signed for the first 6 years of its existence till 2002. State of Florida signed the first agreement in 2002. By the end of 2005, there were only three agreements in effect. By the end of 2006, there were only eight agreements in effect. And not only was it a very small number, but the focus of these agreements was targeted with special interest of populations that they were supposed to target. Then something suddenly happened in 2007 and 2008. About 26 new agreements were signed in 2007, and about 28 new agreements were signed in 2008. So the numbers obviously increased, but also something else was happening to these agreements. They were getting more generic in nature, and they were increasingly becoming sort of instruments to pick up as many unauthorized persons in the localities as possible. By the time the Obama administration took office, there was some speculation that the new administration would terminate the program. In the summer of 2009, in an announcement by the DHS secretary, they not only decided to continue the program, but actually added a few new agreements. And in announcing that, they said the program would be reformed. And at the heart of the reform were two elements. A new standardized agreement was issued, which not only the additional jurisdictions were going to sign, but all the earlier jurisdictions were going to sign on to the new agreement. And the new agreement established a hierarchy of immigrants which are of interest to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement in terms of the targets of these programs. So in one way, there was some speculation that in the new MOA and its implementation, we're coming full circle back to the earlier days of its program when it was focused and targeted. So that, when we realized in the fall of 2009 that this program was going to stay, we decided it was time to look at the programs both in terms of its impact and in terms of its actual implementation on the ground. So with 71 agreements in effect in fall, we decided to do the study that we are now issuing the report about today. There were obviously other reasons to do this at that point, and let me just point out two for all of us. One was clear that in this evolution of devolution, if I can use the term, of immigration authority from federal to the state levels, 287G program provides a very important lens to look at other partnership agreements between ICE and states and localities. Of increasing importance here is the ICE's new program called Secure Communities, which has now galloped to about pretty close to 1,000 jurisdictions around the country and is going to become a national program by 2013, and the increasing use of the criminal alien program in the jails. So it was clear that these programs were going to be an increasing element of the relationship between states and the federal government. And the other reason to do this, frankly, was that by 2009, it was becoming clear that any comprehensive immigration reform was not going to happen anytime soon. So immigration enforcement policy was going to be the center of our immigration policy in general for the foreseeable future. So we launched ahead with our study. How did we do this? First, we looked at the new agreement and compared to the old agreements. We issued a report about the nature of the new agreement and how it was expected to be implemented in the field. We issued a report last fall called Program and Flux, a look at the new agreement. Then we decided to pick 7 sites for the study. And the 7 sites we picked were Gwinnett County and Cobb County in Georgia, the Frederick County in Maryland, Prince William and the neighboring counties in Virginia, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and the big county jail in Los Angeles. We picked these because it was a combination of old and the new models. It was a combination of the bigger and the smaller programs, and it had some geographic diversity. It was also a combination of the jail and the task force models, which you'll hear about a little more. And we reached out to ICE and asked them to share some data, which they had not publicly shared with others. We got significant cooperation from the ICE headquarters, especially in terms of releasing data to us about the characteristics of the people on whom detainers are placed by these local law enforcement authorities. Then we went out in the field. We met with the ICE regional directors and the senior staff. We met with the sheriffs and the local law enforcement officers in charge of the 287G enforcement programs. And we met with elected officials both on the pro and the con side of this issue. And we met close to 100 community leaders, from civil liberties lawyers to immigration lawyers to people who run domestic violence clinics, to school teachers and supervisors in school districts. So at the end of this, we did most of this in spring and the summer of this year, and it took us these few months to write the report. So this is the product of this journey. There are 4 co-authors, and we're all here today. Before Randy comes up to discuss the findings of the report, let me introduce 2 of our other co-authors who are equally important to this task, if not more. Mark Rosenberg, my colleague, the senior policy analyst at MPI, who is the only political scientist on this panel, so always asked us to look at the big picture. And my co-conspirator at NYU Law School, my colleague Christina Rodriguez, who is now on leave from MPI, is also a senior fellow at MPI. So Randy, why don't you come up? Randy is not only the senior policy analyst at MPI, is a distinguished demographer, which made sure that we had our methodology straight about this project and made sense of the numbers. So Randy Capps.
Thank you, Moose, for that kind introduction, and thanks, everyone, for coming today. These are the central questions that we address in the report. First of all, what are the outcomes of the 287G program in terms of the types of people who are detained and removed? And here we rely primarily on the data that ICE provided us that tell us about the types of criminal offenses that people committed before going into the 287G program in all the jurisdictions in the country, based on last fiscal year, 2010. Secondly, what are the goals and motivations for the program nationally and locally, those espoused by ICE and the Obama administration, as well as those that have been publicly stated by participating state and local levels of government? Third, how has the program been implemented, not only originally, but as Moose alluded to, since the 2009 program revisions by the Obama administration? How strong is program oversight and supervision? The U.S. General Government Accountability Office and DHS's Office of Inspector General have been highly critical in recent reports of program oversight and supervision, and we wanted to see how this was working in practice in our 7 study sites. What are the program's costs, benefits, and community impacts? Most of these are difficult to quantify, but we do provide both the, if you will, qualitative evidence around these impacts as well as some information more quantitatively. And then finally, we make recommendations for improving the program. There are basically 2 major framing issues around our findings that I would like you to keep in mind during this presentation and as we go forward with the panel. The first of these is on the level of targeting, again, which Moose alluded to, has changed somewhat over the course of the program's history. Should the 287G program focus on people that the federal government has identified as top enforcement priorities? These are people who are security threats, who've committed serious crimes, you might call them dangerous or violent criminals, or who have prior deportation orders or otherwise multiple immigration violations. Or on the other hand, should the program remove as many unauthorized immigrants as possible, even if they do not fit one of these publicly stated federal priorities? The second big question is, like any program that involves a federal partnership with state and local government, what's the proper balance between uniformity and federal control of the program versus the flexibility and state and local program direction? Okay, so a second important thing to understand is how ICE has defined and classified the people going through the program in terms of their criminal offenses. This is taken from the 2009 standard agreement that all of the programs renegotiated last year. Level 1 offenses are your major drug offenses or violent offenses such as murder, manslaughter, etc. And level 2 offenses are more minor drug offenses and property offenses. And in some revisions to these guidelines last summer, ICE essentially equates level 1 and level 2 with felonies. So for the purposes of our thinking in the report, level 1 and level 2 are your serious crimes, including violent crimes and felonies. Level 3 offenses are misdemeanors, and in the case of the data we looked at, sometimes include only civil offenses. And then finally, traffic offenses. And traffic offenses are not, and it's at the very bottom of the slide down there, I see. Traffic offenses in the data we looked at are not coded as level 1, 2, and 3. They're in a separate category. They generally mostly involve driving under the influence or driving without a license, although they do, in some cases, include more serious offenses than that. Okay, so what is the 287G program in its current forms? Well, there are essentially 3, the jail model, the task force model, and the hybrid, which involves both kinds of operations in the same jurisdiction. In the jail model, the 287G officers who receive about a month's training at the same academy as the ICE officers do, screen for immigration status in the jail setting. They have the authority to ask people where they were born, when they came into the country, how they came into the country, what their jobs are, et cetera, in order to ascertain their legal status. Then they have the authority, if they believe they are unauthorized or are legal immigrants who have committed a crime that warrants their removal, to place detainers or holds on these individuals for up to 48 hours before ICE can come and transfer them into federal custody. They also have the authority to generate removal charges. That is, to write up the formal documents, the notice to appear and other documents that place these immigrants in proceedings for removal, often before immigration judges. They do all of this when immigrants are booked into jail. That is, when the police first bring them to jail at the beginning of their booking and often before conviction. Arresting officers, however, in the jail model usually don't work for the same agency as the 287G officers. The 287G officers usually work for a county sheriff that operates the jail in most cases. The arresting officers work for a county or local police department, often with a separate chain of command. The arresting officers in the jail model generally do not have federal training or authority to inquire about immigration status. Now, in the task force model, the 287G officers are the arresting officers, and they perform the screening often in the field. They can place the detainers in the field before immigrants are brought into jail. They often do their operations jointly with federal agencies such as ICE, DEA, or FBI. And according to the 2009 program revisions, they are supposed to get prior approval for any immigration charge-related arrests. These arresting officers generally, again, do have training from the federal government in immigration law and procedures as opposed to those doing the arresting in the jail model. So, among our sites, we have a mix of these three types. Frederick County, nearby here in Maryland, is a hybrid model. Prince William County in Virginia actually has four different jurisdictions, the two largest of which we studied, including a jail model and a task force model. Cobb and Gwinnett counties, are two Atlanta suburbs, are both jail models, as are Las Vegas and Los Angeles, and these are among the four largest jail models in the country in terms of total volume. And then Colorado has a statewide task force that focuses on immigrant smuggling along the state's major highways. So now to get to the findings. How targeted is the 287G program as currently operated? Well, we found that there is a lot of divergence and classified the programs generally according to the data and our study sites as universal or targeted programs. The universal programs being those that screen and place detainers on virtually everyone encountered in a jail or task force setting. In other words, all the unauthorized immigrants and removable legal immigrants that they encounter get an ICE detainer, get into custody, and begin removal proceedings, regardless of how serious the crime was that they committed in the first place. The targeted programs, by contrast, focus primarily on those with more serious violations. They adhere very closely to what we saw in the 2009 revisions to the program, focusing primarily on level ones and level twos, and less often placing detainers on level three and traffic offenders. Now, in reality, of course, there's variation, with some programs more targeted than others. There's a continuum among our study sites, and if you look in the appendix at the end of the report, there's quite a variety among the 70-odd programs nationally. And then, as far as the second major question about state and local versus federal control, we found, in contrast to some previous reviews of the program, very close supervision by ICE agents of 287G officers. A daily presence in the jail settings and frequent communication and task forces. But we also found that the local ICE officers who supervise the program tend to support the state and local priorities, even when this results in a more universal program. So this is to show you the variation in the types of offenses by the seven study sites and for all jurisdictions, and this is, if you will, the central piece of quantitative data in the report. And if you look at the top bar, which is all the jurisdictions, 70-odd jurisdictions, you can see it's about half and half. The darker green are level ones. The diamondish pattern is the level twos. The lighter green is level threes, and the hash marks are the traffic offenders. And you can see it's about half level ones and level twos, and the other half level threes and traffic offenders. But then you see the variation among our programs. And Colorado is a bit unique, and I have to spend a couple of minutes talking about it. I believe it's purple up there. For Colorado, people have no criminal offenses at all. And the reason why Colorado is unique is because these are people who are arrested during a bust of a smuggling operation. They are often recently just crossed the border illegally and are in transit somewhere. The ICE considers them to be a high priority, even though they haven't, because they haven't been in the country that long, and generally they haven't been in the country long enough to have had the opportunity to commit a criminal offense. But looking at the other programs, Frederick and Cobb counties are the most universal, if you will. 80-odd percent are level 3 or traffic offenses. Only 20% are your serious level 1 and 2 offenses. Prince William County, Gwinnett County, and the Prince William County Jail sort of come in the middle and are very close to the national picture. But I should add that at the time we had these data, Gwinnett County was only a few months into its program, and we were told that over time it is trending to look more like Cobb. And in fact, if you look at their webpage today, several hundred people in Gwinnett County have been referred to ICE for removal just because they were driving without a license. Los Angeles County and Las Vegas are the two most targeted sites we studied and among the two most targeted nationally. And you could see, for instance, in Las Vegas, nearly three-quarters of all the detainers are placed on people with level 1 or 2 offenses. Now, we also looked at how this varies between task forces and jail models across the whole spectrum of 72 programs. And this was the surprise finding for me, not what I expected going into it, but in fact, jails account for 90% of all the program activity in terms of the number of detainers that have been placed. The hybrids that do both account for 8%, and most of these detainers are placed in a jail setting. The pure task forces only account for about 2% of program activity. So this is largely a jail-based program, even though the task forces have received a lot of scrutiny and a lot of public controversy. When you look at the data overall, jails are no more targeted than task forces. In both cases, about half of detainers are placed on level 1s and level 2s. Colorado is really the exception for task forces, again, because it focuses on these smuggling passengers. If you take Colorado out of the data and look at all the other task force agreements, they also have about half on level 1s and 2s and half on 3s and traffic offenders. Another thing we looked at in the data overall is we look for patterns, of course, in terms of which types of programs are more likely to be targeted and which types are more likely to be universal. And as it turns out, the top 12 in terms of the share of traffic offenders are all located in the Southeast, in the states of Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee, and then also Frederick County, Maryland. And you can see that in all 12 of these, half or more of the detainers are essentially placed on people with traffic violations. Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, which is on this list, was the first one to operate what we call the universal jail model, and we believe that most of these other programs in the region were patterned after Mecklenburg. Then we looked at community impacts. One of the things we looked at was patterns of population change. Looking at the American Community Survey data for 2009 and comparing it to the year before the program was implemented in various jurisdictions, we did find Hispanic non-citizen populations falling and at the same time increasing in neighboring counties that, if you will, were more receptive towards immigrants. Here locally, that meant a 60% decline in Frederick County's Hispanic non-citizen population and a slight rise in Montgomery's. In Prince William County, and this has been reported by a recent evaluation of their program by the University of Virginia, there's a significant population decline of around a quarter and a bump up in neighboring Fairfax County. We also found, of course, that most immigrants, in fact, stayed put. And what we were told is that they avoid public places and were less likely to drive. However, the four jurisdictions that we looked at were with these population declines, Prince William, Frederick, Gwinnett, and Cobb counties, which are suburbs of Georgia, are large, sprawling suburban areas with very limited public transportation networks. So people essentially still needed to drive to get to work. They still needed to drive to take their children to school or to school meetings, et cetera. And for these essential activities, they continued driving, but we were told they curtailed their driving and other types of activities, were less likely to participate, for instance, in parental activities in the schools and less likely to patronize local businesses. They also expressed fear and mistrust of the police and reluctance to report crimes. We heard a lot about racial profiling. This has been talked about in other reports. Both crime reporting rates and racial profiling rates are very difficult to prove quantitatively. We did not attempt to do so. However, there's plenty of evidence, and you'll hear about this later on in the panel, that the fear and mistrust of the police has changed behaviors and potentially made communities less safe. And there's been great public controversy in these sites. Now, the sites where these impacts were widespread are, again, our universal jurisdictions, in particular, Cobb and Gwinnett counties in Georgia and Frederick, Maryland. Most of this is tied to traffic arrests. What people are most afraid of is being arrested while they are driving. And these places often have state and local laws and ordinances that target immigrants, the most effective of which, among our study sites, is a Georgia state law that requires somebody to be taken to jail if they're caught driving without a license and imposes a felony penalty on the fourth time. And this has enabled the police to bring in a large number of people. Unauthorized immigrants can't get licenses in the state of Georgia, into jail for screening and eventual deportation and removal. These types of community impacts were less common in our more targeted jurisdictions, if you will, those in the middle. In Colorado, in addition, it's a statewide program, so the operations are not concentrated in particular neighborhoods, so you don't see neighborhood-specific impacts. And Prince William County has evolved its program over time into a more targeted fashion. Prince William had an ordinance on the books that was very similar to Arizona's law that would have authorized police to stop and question people at any time about their legal status, but they backtracked on that law. When they implemented 287G, they did it in a more targeted fashion, and they've done a lot of community outreach, all of which, if you will, has dialed back the controversy in Prince William significantly. And these types of impacts are the least significant in our largest city sites of Las Vegas and Los Angeles, where the programs are most targeted, and where, despite the fact they're large volume programs, they're not making as much of an impact compared to the other things going on in the community. So in conclusion, we find that ICE tolerates a high degree of ambiguity in priorities and variation in outcomes across 287G jurisdictions. The universal programs have substantial community impacts and downstream federal detention and removal costs. ICE just publicized last week that it costs an average of $12,500 to detain and remove someone from the country. We didn't do a comprehensive accounting of this, and of course it varies a lot from case to case. But if you're talking about 60,000 odd detainers placed on people, half of which are for less serious offenses, we're talking about tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars spent every year in detaining and removing these people. The targeted programs have lower costs, of course, because they're going to yield smaller numbers, and they better fit enforcement priorities, I would say, given our current budget debate about cutting discretionary spending in the government. Universal enforcement is not limited to task forces. In fact, more of it occurs in jail settings than in task forces, and the jails have this additional accountability problem that the arresting officers don't work for the same department and are not overseen and supervised by ICE. And finally, the Secure Communities Program, which involves when people's fingerprints are taken in the jail, the information from the fingerprints is sent up to ICE's database and matched against their records to see if that person has committed a prior immigration offense. That Secure Communities Program, as Moose mentioned, is almost in 1,000 jurisdictions, is going to be nationwide. And because it is a universal screening program, potentially, may face some of the same difficulties that we see with 287G, albeit on a much larger scale. So our recommendations are that ICE should implement a targeted program focusing primarily, if not exclusively, on level one and level two offenders and multiple immigration offenders, really following what we would say is the Las Vegas model. We also recommend, and this is something that we can talk about a little bit more in question and answer, that detainers be placed after conviction as they do in Los Angeles. This ensures that people actually are convicted of the crimes they committed before they're deported. Investigate racial profiling. This is a recommendation that the Office of Inspector General made actually twice that ICE has still not followed. The U.S. Department of Justice would need to be involved in this. We recommend that they discontinue the universal jurisdictions and weigh the costs and benefits of the program overall versus secure communities and other types of partnerships. If ICE decides to keep the program in its current form, it should only expand it to jurisdictions that are likely to operate targeted programs and without a history of racial profiling. And finally, and I think this is a very important point, ICE itself, along with the partner agencies, should conduct more outreach about the program. And some jurisdictions, including Las Vegas and especially Prince William County, are already doing this, and it helps to dispel community fears. This should involve advisory committees, if you will, that involve members of the community, as well as public statements about the purpose of the program. And with that, you can see here again at the bottom of this slide our phone number and web page if you have further questions and want further information. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy, and you can take your seat at the podium. Let me ask Captain Leroy Kierkegaard of the Las Vegas Police Department to speak next. Captain Kierkegaard, has the oversight of the 287G program in Las Vegas. He was involved in the inception of the program and has the supervision on a daily basis of the program since it started. Christina and I were guests of the jail for about a day, which did cause some consternation in our families, but we were very well received there. I also learned that Captain Kirkidot is endearingly called Captain K all over Las Vegas, and this is his first visit to Washington, D.C. So, Captain K, welcome to the nation's capital.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. I'm very excited to be here. I'm an operational level captain in Las Vegas. Our executive staff, our sheriff, was unable to attend because of other commitments in Las Vegas. I tried very hard to get him here, but after talking with everybody from MPI, they wanted somebody from the operational level anyway, so here I am. I'd like to thank the Migration Policy Institute, number one, for coming to Las Vegas and taking a look at our program. And secondly, the invitation here today. I appreciate that and have an opportunity to share our program with everybody here. We're very proud of what we've done in Las Vegas. As a study indicates, immigration policies have become a major focus of concern in the last few years. And I just want everybody to understand I'm not here to represent any political viewpoint, or I'm just, like I said, an operational person. I like this study, and I think this study has done a great job informing all interested parties of the challenges and offers of solutions to some of these challenges in the immigration policies. It opens that door to further discussion and understanding. That open discussion and transparency are two factors that have played a large role in the success of the program in Las Vegas. A little historical, back in January of 2007, Sheriff Doug Gillespie took his oath of office as the first, as the sheriff of Clark County and the leader of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, we incorporated about 37 years ago, so we do not have a Clark County Sheriff's Department. It's all under the Metropolitan Police Department. So the Detention Services Division, where I work, falls under the Sheriff Gillespie also. One of the first things that Sheriff Gillespie did was sit down with his executive staff. I was a part of the executive staff back in 2007. And we came up with a vision statement in Las Vegas. Sheriff Gillespie and executive staff, we decided we wanted to make Las Vegas the safest community in America. With that vision statement, we started our strategic planning. In April of 2007, 287G program came up. It was part of our strategic planning and how we'd be able to use this program to help reach that lofty vision of making Las Vegas the safest community in America. It wasn't an easy decision. We researched, did a lot of research. We made a lot of phone calls. We did site visits for 4 or 5 months before we even signed the initial application. We made a lot of phone calls to ICE, the local office, the FOD office, the field office in Salt Lake City, and calls out here to Washington to answer all of our questions before we committed to the 287G program. Our formal application was done in August of 2007. We signed our first MOA in August of 2008, and our program began operations in November of 2008. I'm not going to discuss a lot of our numbers here today, but everybody here at the MPI asked me to talk about our successes, why we're successful in Las Vegas. Well, number one, and I just touched on it briefly, we did our homework. From April of 2007 into 2008, we talked to current agencies. People got really tired of us calling them, emailing them, going to visit them. We went and visited agencies in California, Arizona, and looked at a lot of different agencies. And we were fortunate is that we built our program on their successes and their challenges they faced. And we took that all into account when we were putting together our 287G program in Las Vegas. Another thing that was very important to our success is our selection criteria for our corrections officers. Once we decided that we were going to put in the application for the 287G, we went around to each and every platoon. There's about 880 officers that work at the Clark County Detention Center. And we went around to each and every shift and explained the program to them, what the sheriff wanted, the sheriff's vision, the sheriff's goals with this program, and sought input and got volunteers And once those people volunteered, they went through interview processes, oral boards. We did background checks on them. We checked the personnel files. And 24 people put in for it. We selected 10 people to go to the FLETC training. Why that's important is these 10 officers are still working in the program today, but got their buy-in, and they helped develop this program along with local ICE office from the ground up. That created ownership and buy-in of this program and created a voice for us out in the community. These guys had to go out and meet with community leaders and everything. Relationship building and constant communication with ICE personnel throughout the initial process, initial phases, and continuing today. We're fortunate in Las Vegas, the ICE office is just down the street. We have a nice supervisor on site that supervises our cross-designated officers. We have regular meetings between the ICE supervisors and a lieutenant that actually oversees directly over the program and a sergeant and the 10 officers. They meet regularly. I have monthly meetings with the ICE and members from the RO staff. And our annual meetings that the sheriff has with the field office director out of Salt Lake City are very informative. We just don't meet because MOA says we have to meet. We actually sit down and talk about challenges, concerns, way to do things better. And I'm sure the sheriff probably talks to people over the FOD's head too. I'm almost sure of it, but I don't. So. The program transparency. This is something that Doug Gillespie, Sheriff Gillespie, has talked about since he initially took office in 2007 and continues to talk about it today. We're very transparent with everything we do in the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. We had several media contacts and media interviews prior to the implementation in 2008. In November of 2008, we held a press conference with our ICE partner sitting at the table with us and announced our plans to start this 287G program. We opened up our doors to the media. We print, radio, TV. Everybody could come into the jail and take a look at the program. They can interview the officers. If the people that have been arrested are willing to do it, they can interview those people that have been arrested. One of the important things we did along with that is we made sure all of the patrol function in Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was briefed on what we were doing. It's very, Sheriff wanted very clear to all the entire agency and the community that what we were doing was going to target those people that were charged with a violent offense, that we were not going to arrest people out on the street. By explaining that program to the patrol officers and special teams that work out in the communities every day, that started to help alleviate those concerns and fears that the community had. And it went a long ways in the success of our program. And the other thing we do as far as transparency, a lot of things, special meetings, town hall meetings. We've attended town hall meetings. We have our first Tuesday at our area commands where the community is invited and we can talk about the 287G program. Since the Hispanic Citizens Academy, we do presentation there and any community meetings that they have, if we are invited, they want to talk about it, we're sure to send a representative to those. And from a more operational standpoint, we do a monthly 287G statistical report. My lieutenant does. That's shared with not only the sheriff, but it's sent to our Office of Public Information to disseminate to anybody in the media that wants to look at those numbers. Very clear, specific direction for our program was and continues to be the removal of violent offenders from the communities of Las Vegas. In 2008, we established a priority system based on criminal charges of the people that were being brought into booking. So when we signed the new MOA in July of 2009, there wasn't a big change for us. With the level 1, level 2, and level 3 offenders, we were already doing it. That was something the sheriff wanted us to do, and that's something that my guys working in that program wanted to do. We wanted to target the serious offenders that were being brought into the jail. And just so I'm perfectly clear, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department does not arrest subjects based on immigration status. They're arrested if somebody's arrested on the street or they've got a bench warrant for a traffic ticket. Nothing from an immigration standpoint is done until that person walks in the door. Once that person walks in the door, based on his status as a foreign-born, if he or she admits to being foreign-born, That's what starts the process for us. Our 287G cross-designated officers take a look at them, they question them, they do very in-depth questions with them, and determine whether or not these people are going to go, if they're going to start removal proceedings. I guess one of the things that I want to impress upon everybody is the relationship again with ICE, and we're fortunate that we have a great group of people working together, working with ICE. But this is the sheriff's program, and we're doing it with the assistance of ICE and the ERO. And the sheriff is very clear on how he wants this program to be handled, and we've been doing that since November of 2008. We have a very successful program, which the study details. The success is a result of very specific objectives, a plan of action, and these objectives shared with all participants in the management of the program. No hidden agendas with the public or community, being involved and available to answer questions and address concerns. We've always had a productive relationship with our ICE partners, and the 287G program has just helped make this more successful. Thank you.
Our last panelist is Jerry Gonzalez, who is the executive director of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials. Randy and I spent a lot of time in Atlanta, and from our conversations, we found Jerry one of the most keen observers of the 287G program in the metropolitan Atlanta area, which covers more than one 287G program. He has observed its impact in the community for a long time and has also seen the state legislature action, which obviously directly impacts on how the 287G program is implemented in Cobb and Gwinnett County. So, Jerry?
My name is Jerry Gonzalez. I am Executive Director of the Georgia Association of Latino Elected Officials, known as GALEO. GALEO was founded in 2003 to enhance and increase civic engagement and leadership development of the Latino community all across the great state of Georgia. Under civic engagement, primary focus regarding policy has been the of a cohesive federal immigration policy. We've also been working very diligently against any attempt to regulate, enforce federal immigration law at the local or state level. Georgia is the second worst state in the country when it comes to creating a hostile environment for Latinos or immigrants, second only to Arizona. And I want to lay a little context here. In 2006, the Georgia legislature passed immigrant legislation specifically targeting immigrants, not employers, immigrants, that attempted to create an attrition through enforcement policy objective. It started with the encouragement of 287G participation as a state policy objective. It then expanded this passage of anti-immigrant legislation every single year since then. But it then expanded passage of legislation that essentially made driving without a license for undocumented immigrants, it specifically targeted undocumented immigrants, as a jailable offense. And then the 287G programs went into effect. The 287G program, and I want to be clear about this, the 287G program, in its intent, should be commended to ensure that there is a removal process for people that commit serious crimes in our country. However, in practice, what we see in the data, in Georgia specifically, and in other parts, that's not the case. Furthering a hostile environment in Georgia, this past week, the Georgia House of Representatives moved further by introducing a copycat of an Arizona law, which will get a public hearing this Friday. In the Georgia Senate, another Arizona copycat law was introduced that would exempt enforcement among the agricultural industry. Clearly, the pressure from the Georgia Farm Bureau's opposition to these measures is being felt, considering Georgia's leading industry is agriculture, and that 50 to 70% of the nation's agricultural workforce is undocumented. This poses a very serious problem for our agricultural industry back in Georgia. Again, this type of political posturing has created an extremely hostile environment in Georgia for both Latinos and foreigners. Let me explain. Shortly after passage of Georgia's omnibus anti-immigrant legislation in 2006, there was an international incident that I want to remind everybody about. Cheryl Kuhn, a Canadian citizen, was traveling through Georgia on her way to Florida, as many Canadians do. She was pulled over for a minor traffic violation. Because of confusion about the state's recently passed law at the time, a state trooper arrested her after finding out she was a foreign citizen. At the local jail, there was also confusion about what to do about foreign nationals in jails. She was forced to, they forced her through a strip search, they deloused her, and she spent 10 hours overnight in a jail for a minor traffic violation. This caused the Canadian government to consider issuing a travel advisory against Canadians going through Georgia or to Georgia. Nothing was done about the situation, and quickly, Georgia's leadership tried to brush it under the rug. Again, this is what happens when no training of law enforcement officials occurs, and when law enforcement officials that are not trained try to implement an enforcement scheme of a federal immigration law. Just this past week, I spoke with a man who was detained in a standard roadblock in Gwinnett County. This man is a legal permanent resident and was detained and put under arrest for allegedly driving under the influence. He does speak with an accent. During no time, either prior to the arrest or after the arrest, was he subjected to a test to determine his alcohol level. The man insisted that he shouldn't be detained. They put him on an immigration hold. He insisted they shouldn't put him on an immigration hold because he was a legal permanent resident. Within 48 hours, he was released. The man described the environment that he was going through, sort of like a witch hunt for Latinos, because all that they were arresting were Latinos in Georgia on made-up offenses. The man further indicated during his stay that he was talking to some of the people in the jail. People were being arrested for walking. People were being approached by law enforcement officials in Gwinnett County and asked for ID, and asked for their immigration study status. Again, the Gwinnett County Police Department doesn't have training or authority to be able to ask for immigration status, yet that is occurring. Why? Because they know once they take somebody to the Gwinnett County Jail, they will be subject to an immigration check. There was a victim of domestic violence that was sent to court that ultimately she was trying to arrange for payment of her traffic violation driving without a license. She was in process of getting a U visa, making sure that she was living up to her obligations of driving without a license. She asked the judge for an arrangement to pay for her fine. The judge said no, sent her to jail. While in jail, a 287G agreement, ICE officers and 287G deputies were trying to force her to sign a voluntary removal, deportation. Her abuser, by the way, was already out of jail. Yet she remained in jail until we intervened and we had to make sure that people in the Gwinnett County Sheriff's Office knew that they should not be holding this victim of domestic violence. As a community leader, I have received phone calls whenever a house gets broken into. I have received phone calls when people have been assaulted. I have received phone calls when people get burglarized. I, as a community leader, should not be getting phone calls with regards to public safety. They are afraid to call police. What does that do for public safety in our communities if the immigrant community is not willing or able, out of fear, to call 911 to report a crime? There is even a situation when an elderly man suffered a stroke, went several days without seeking medical treatment for fear of being deported. In Hall County, which is not subject to the report, they're arresting people for fishing without a license. Fishing without a license. These stories highlight the crumbling of community policing efforts in Georgia and indicate a diminishing of public safety for all Georgians. When immigrants choose to avoid all interaction with law enforcement officials, it makes us all less safe and it diminishes our public safety. Under the current lack of accountability by the Obama administration for these 287G agreements, situations like these will continue and will be made worse through the expansion of secure communities. I applaud commendable efforts by the local law enforcement officials like Nevada who are using this power judiciously and do take this approach in a very targeted manner. I also applaud their efforts for working with community members to ensure that they focus on the business of public safety and enhancing community policing efforts. However, in a highly charged political environment like Georgia, where politics of the day supersedes smart law enforcement practices, then one has to question the delegation of such important federal power of immigration enforcement. When sheriffs with this power refuse to meet with community members to address the very serious concerns about the impact of public safety, then one has to question the true priorities the Obama administration truly has for this program. Unfortunately, programs in Georgia have been subjected to a high degree of politics of the day, and law enforcement officials are abusing their power. The Gwinnett County Sheriff has openly spoken about removing all undocumented immigrants from the county through the use of this program. There is rampant racial profiling occurring in Georgia today. Clearly, this goes against the stated objectives as laid out by the Obama administration, yet the program continues. Politics is dictating the practices in Georgia rather than the concern for enhancing public safety and community policing efforts. In Georgia, there is also an incentive for profit. There are several for-profit prisons and detention facilities operating in Georgia. So there is a significant for-profit incentive in order for these things to continue. The Obama administration went to court in Arizona to stop these types of practices from occurring with the infamous SB 1070. However, under the current conditions with the 287G program in Georgia, the Obama administration is enabling the very kind of environment that it moved to stop in Arizona. In my opinion, it is time to rein in the delegation of authority and to work uniformly across the nation with the stated objectives of removing serious criminals and to stop the deportation of hardworking people with minor traffic violations. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry, and we are exactly on time for 30 minutes of question and answer. Again, to repeat what I said earlier, this is being videotaped and it will be on our website, I think, at the end of the day or as soon as we can, so people can access it. We'll take about a few minutes of question and answer. Please identify yourself and your affiliation, and if you can direct it to a particular panelist, please do that.
My name is Sonia Velasquez from American Humane Association. We work with child welfare agencies across the country. And one of our concerns in issues of immigration is the well-being of children of immigrant families. And there are two issues around this from what I have been hearing on the study. One is related to children who are citizens because of birth, and their parents are subject to removal. So what have you seen in the course of the sites and the study? What are good practices and what are issues related to this? And the other one is, in general, the immediate protection of children when parents are removed. What are the policies? Is child welfare responding adequately to protect children who are left in abandonment?
Yes, thank you, Sonia. That's a very good question, and I should mention that I have done some research closer to that topic with A.J. Chaudhry, who's actually here today from Urban Institute and others there. And in general, what we found after these raids is that there are dilemmas for parents as to whether or not they want to take the citizen children with them when they're deported or leave them here. Now, the 287G program and these programs focusing on people who've committed crimes are a little different from some of the other immigration enforcement in a couple of ways, one of which is that some people are already in the jail setting. So there may be a long period when they're serving a sentence for a crime they've committed of separation prior to even going into removal proceedings. Another thing is it is predominantly men. So unlike some of the larger worksite raids that we've seen where there are a lot of mothers arrested, and a lot of times it's fathers and the mothers are still in the community. That said, there are mothers who are arrested as well, and these dilemmas are still faced. Now, we didn't explore this in detail in the study. I also think when there's local law enforcement involved, there's more opportunity than when ICE is just coming into a community from afar for the local law enforcement to have communication with people at the local level as far as what happens with the families. I think there's an additional child welfare issue, though, that's raised by these, and Jerry alluded to it, which is the fear of people to contact authorities when there is abuse occurring in the home, particularly when they fear that both parents might be arrested until they sort things out and figure out who's at fault, with the risk of both the abuser and the abusee eventually getting detained and deported.
Jerry, go ahead.
If I could add to that, I want to talk about two examples. There's many more, but two examples. A 10-year-old boy was going to school with his mother, and he's a U.S. citizen, and his parents are undocumented. And one time that he was going to school, he went into a panic because he saw a police car close to the school, and he was frantic. And because of that incident, he urinated on himself. And every time he sees a police car, he urinates on himself because of the fact that he fears that the police are going to take mommy and daddy away. That is such a tremendous, traumatic mental health impact on the life of this child. Also, there's been a situation where parents were both removed from a home. 18-year-old college student is taking responsibility for raising his siblings and is raising them without any outreach for help because of fear of reaching out for help, because some of the kids are undocumented, some of the kids are U.S. citizens. So here you have an 18-year-old going to college and raising a family of five in this situation, and they're afraid to reach out for help. So that is what's happening in Georgia, and it is a very traumatic experience that further study needs to be held with regard to the impact on both U.S.-born children of immigrants, but also to undocumented children, of which there's millions in this country already.
Captain, you want to respond from local law enforcement perspective?
Yeah, if I could. Again, being operational from a detention perspective, we don't get into this a lot. I'm aware of the concerns. When we are interviewing, when my officers are interviewing the people that have been brought in, they find out if there are children in the home, and they actually put that in the report, and it is my understanding that the immigration judges are made aware of it, and then that takes its own course, however that may be. But again, we don't see these people until they're actually arrested, and that's when we have our first contact with them. So,
Jean?
Hi, Jean Butterfield with the Raven Group. Thank you to the panel. It's a wealth of information and data and analysis. I had a question for Captain Kierkegaard. It sounds like you're program questions people upon arrest, and I just wondered what the difference would be if the people were questioned upon conviction, and whether in your background work with some of the other departments around the country, if you found that pretextual arrests are a concern and an issue. I think Jerry has raised a couple of those examples. I'm just wondering what would be the relative merits of restricting the program to cases of people who've already been convicted of those tier 1 and 2 crimes.
We're a little different in Las Vegas than L.A. is. I know L.A. uses the post-conviction model. When somebody, and I'll review this very quickly, but
When somebody's arrested, if they come in, one of the questions that are asked is if they were born in the United States. And if that answer is no, then they go over and they go through this entire process. If it's a serious offense, our concern is this with the post-conviction model. If bail is raised or the person's let out of custody and this person has a history prior to that, those local charges being completed, that person, if he can make bail, will be out in the community and could go back wherever and disappear from the community, and they will never face those charges. Once we get them through the ICE process or the 287G process, even if they're not convicted later on, if they are convicted later on, there is a warrant and that follows them, that deportation proceeding follows them through the prison. So from my perspective, this may sound simplistic, but it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. We don't house anybody at the county jail that's been convicted of any felony crimes. They're all housed in the state prison system. And we have right around 300 to 400 people in our custody at any one time that are waiting some type of criminal charges to be finished. So post-conviction models, could it work? I don't know. I think it's can be discussed further. And that's one of the things I like about this report is it opens up some ideas and gives us all an opportunity to talk about these things.
Ajay, out here.
Hi, Ajay Chaudhry of the Urban Institute. Randy, in the presentation you mentioned that there was some slight population shifts in some of the areas where there were where there are 287G agreements. I want to know if you've had a chance to look at or anybody's looked at whether there's changes in school enrollments that occur as a result. I know that the Prince William study, either at the University of Virginia or George Mason, has shown some shift between those counties and Fairfax of kids moving. And then maybe if the gentleman from Georgia could also comment on whether, because in some cases you can't, there's not really a good county to move to if you're a Latino family.
Well, yes, and I neglected to mention during the presentation that we looked at both school enrollment data and American Community Survey data, and they showed a similar pattern. So we did see, these are sort of, if you will, outlying suburban areas with high growth, very high growth, in Hispanic enrollment for several years, up in some cases up until the point in which 287G is implemented, at which point you see, you know, the rate of enrollment increase for Hispanic students, say, dropping from 5 to 1% or going below zero and actually being negative. What was interesting, and this was true in Cobb County, it was true in Frederick County, and it was true in Prince William County, the same three that showed the drop in overall Hispanic non-citizen populations in the American Community Survey data. And we have some figures to that effect in the report. What was interesting, though, was that the school district data showed that the next year, enrollment bounced back. And that's an interesting finding we can't quite explain. We don't have a long time series because these programs were only implemented 2 or 3 years ago. For instance, we couldn't look at Gwinnett County because they only implemented their program in 2009 and there wasn't another school year to look at. But it does suggest some readjustment going on. Now, the Prince William County evaluation done by the University of Virginia suggests that actually families with children stayed put and it was more likely to be the single people who didn't have as strong roots in the community that left right after 287G was implemented. So shorter-term immigrants, solo men who were not married, didn't have families there, were more likely to leave than the families. That may be part of the story. Or it may be that other families moved in. When you look at the data for school enrollment, you can't tell who's a citizen and who's not, who's unauthorized and who's not. You just know the race, ethnicity, because they don't record those other things. So it could also be that legal immigrants and citizens who happen to be Latino moved in to replace unauthorized who moved out.
If I could add from my observations, and again, these are not research-based observations. They're more anecdotal from what I've heard from the community. In Cobb County, when it was the first program that go into effect in Georgia, and there was flight. Apartment occupancy rates in the area that were heavily Latino-focused went from 95% occupancy rate to about 60% occupancy rate. And school enrollment in those areas also dropped. However, as other 287G jurisdictions came into effect, We saw a significant spike in when Gwinnett County came on first on board, a significant spike of people being deported in Gwinnett County. However, shortly thereafter, there's been a decline of the number of people that have been deported. And the sheriff touts it as a success of the program because there's less recidivism of people removing people. But the reality is, sheriff doesn't know what he's talking about. What the sheriff is seeing is that ultimately the community has adjusted to ensure that they can avoid detection or interaction with law enforcement officials. As an example, one example that I'll give, I don't want to give all the community's secrets away, but ultimately one of the examples of adjustment is that people text, said people mass text where there is a roadblock, where there is police activity, where there are police cars, and people do that very frequently. So it's not a success of the program that the numbers have gone down. It's an indication of the community adjusting to the realities of the situation, really what we've seen in Georgia. Because there are very few places to go where you are likely not to have those encounters. So I think the community has adjusted to the realities of the situation and have altered their driving patterns, shopping patterns to fit that accordingly as well.
Next.
Joan Friedland from the National Immigration Law Center. I appreciate the report, which does have such a wealth of information in it. But the report does outline many serious deficiencies in the operation of 287G, as have previous reports from the GAO and the Office of Inspector General and various NGOs. And the report makes good recommendations about substantial changes that should take place in the program, as have all the previous reports. So I'm wondering what evidence you have of ICE intent to make the serious changes in the program that would be required, particularly as you look at secure communities expanding at a record pace without those improvements having been made. Thank you.
Randy?
That is probably the most difficult question that you could ask, but I would say that we looked for evidence of changes because of the 2009 program reforms, which were done in part in response to those earlier critical reports, and sort of at the, if you will, operational and data collection level, they did do some things. They started to collect who's got a level 1, 2, et cetera, offense. They have a comprehensive case management system that people appear to be using. They do have fairly tight supervision in the jurisdictions we went to. However, shifting the program's direction away from those state and local, if you will, politically led priorities is going to be more difficult. I mean, that's where the real action is. That's where the rubber meets the road. We do not know how they're going to respond to that. And our hope is, since they were willing to share the data with us, they were willing to let us talk to their field officers, and that we have presented findings to them and will continue to interact with them, that they will take this seriously and that they will operate towards a more targeted model and understand what the difficulties are. But, of course, it's a political issue. I mean, this is part of the broader political issue of what should our interior enforcement strategy be, given that it's unlikely we're going to have comprehensive immigration reform soon. In fact, whatever 287G and secure community programs and other programs like them do may become the de facto U.S. immigration policy with regard to the unauthorized population. And it certainly is possible if you remove 400,000 or more people a year and you do it comprehensively through every jail in the country, as well as some other minor operations, that you could start to reduce the population somewhat. And so we don't know if that's their goal. We push back in the report and say that it's not worth it. It's a lot of money, a lot of federal money. They spent $5 billion last year just on detaining and removing people. And it's a lot of adverse community impact. And it does take away from prioritizing and focusing on the more serious criminals. And so that's where we come down on it, and we hope that they will take that seriously. But, of course, it's going to be a political issue, and there will need to be pressure brought to bear on the administration to follow up on this.
Hi, Shantae Brown from DHS OIG. I had a quick question for Captain Kay. It seems like this program is really, I guess, working in Las Vegas. I was wondering, had there been any cross analysis in terms of, I guess, overall violent crime rates since the implementation of 287G?
We haven't focused on the 287G program and its impact on reducing crime rates, but in 2009, our violent crimes were reduced by about 5.3%. Property crimes were reduced by about 4.9%. And if the sheriff ever watches this and I got those percentages wrong, I'm probably going to be in trouble. The 2010 numbers, of course, aren't out and won't come out till later on in the year, but in the last 5 years, we've seen a reduction of 25% in our violent crimes in Las Vegas Valley. And we attributed that to we've got a lot of cops on the street out there. Prior Sheriff Bill Young got a More Cops initiative passed, and we were able to hire about 550 more cops put on the street. So we're focusing on getting our cops in the communities and fighting crime at the community level. And a lot of initiatives the sheriff has put, again, the strategic planning process, it's all been very positive. And the 287G has a portion of that, I'm sorry. But we just don't know for sure what exactly those numbers are.
On the flip side of that, in Georgia, I think that looking at the crime reports is not a good indicator of actual crime that is taking place. Given the reluctance of community members to come forward, whether they see a burglary, whether they are victims of crime, or whether they see any kind of other serious crime, community members are not coming forward, so therefore the statistics within Georgia are skewed to where, for example, the police in Cobb County say that crime has gone down. No, the reality in Cobb County is that crime is not being reported. And criminals are targeting the undocumented population because they know that they are less likely to report crime. So crime is happening, and crime has probably increased. Given this recession that we're in, yes, crime has probably increased, but the Cobb County Police Department has no clue because they're not coming forward to report the crime. So it's the flip side of what we're seeing in a highly politicized environment that we have in Georgia is that it's diminishing public safety for everybody because, again, if you have a segment of the population that's not willing to come forward to report suspicious or criminal activity, then it makes us all less safe.
Okay, if not, let me give our panelists a few quick minutes to say concluding remarks on the basis of what you couldn't say in your initial presentation or on the basis of what you heard here this morning. Captain, why don't you start?
Well, I'll be very brief. I just want to once again thank the Migration Policy Institute. This has been quite an experience for me. Those of you that are here can probably tell I'm not used to sitting in front of a group of people like this, but I was glad to come out here and sell our program a little bit. A lot of work can be done. Studies like this, as I mentioned earlier, open the door to that communication and people working together and trying to get things done and getting this to be meeting these challenges head on as teamwork. And we can improve on our program. I think we got a pretty good program right now, but there's always room for improvement. And I look forward to getting the study. I haven't shared this study with ICE, my counterparts in the ERO office yet. Wouldn't talk to anybody about it, as a matter of fact, until this was released today. So, but I'll be sitting down and talking to them, and if there's anything we can do better out of this, we're going to sure talk about it. Again, thank you for the opportunity, and if you're ever in Vegas, you can come visit the jail, but don't come to jail, okay?
I quit it. Jerry, can we come and visit Atlanta now?
You can come visit Atlanta. Just bring your passports with you. I want to thank the Migration Policy Institute for this great report. I think it does point to something that we have already known in the community, is that unfortunately in some jurisdictions, the relegation of immigration enforcement by the federal government has resulted in an abuse of power. And it's the federal government's responsibility to rein in and to ensure that it doesn't enable an Arizona-style situation and doesn't enable further racial profiling. It doesn't enable a diminishing of public safety in our communities. So it is incumbent upon the Obama administration to talk, to walk the talk. It is not doing it. If it means that there is a prioritization of resources and enforcement efforts for people that commit serious crime, and that's the goal and objective of the program, then let's do so. But what is happening in Georgia is clearly a departure, a very significant departure that runs counter to the values of the Obama administration. And I think that the Obama administration needs to be held accountable to make sure it reins back some of that federal divergence of immigration enforcement at the local level. So we hope that the Obama administration will result in further curtailing some of the 287G efforts in Georgia.
Okay, Randy Capps, who did the heavy lifting on this report, gets the last word.
Okay, well, thanks, everyone. I don't know that I have that much more to say. I think the questions were very useful for this, but I think I would come back to the fact that we are at a historical moment where there's momentum in both directions when it comes to local and state policing of immigration laws. There is a very strong groundswell of support for 287G, Arizona law, copycat laws in Georgia and other states. The universal model is in vogue in some places, and I think we have to recognize that. At the same time, the Obama administration's leadership, including the Secretary of Homeland Security and the Director of ICE, are on the record as saying they support enforcement that's targeted toward dangerous criminals. They support reforming the detention system. They support reforming all of these interior enforcement systems. So, you know, it's always nice to say, well, we're at a crossroads. I think what makes us at a bit of a crossroads here is, again, because we don't have comprehensive immigration reform and we have this huge expansion of secure communities, I think that what we're finding with 287G program is going to have very widespread implications across the country in the years to come.
Thank you very much to all the panelists, and if you give them a round of applause. For us at MPI, this is the beginning of the second stage of this process. We want to see how both ICE and localities around the country react to this report, and we look forward to their response. We also look forward to your response, and feel free to give it to us. And as I said, this proceedings of this event will be put on our website, so if others wouldn't have the opportunity to see it, please ask them to visit the website and watch it by the end of the day. Thank you again, and look forward to seeing you at the next MPI event.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.